You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. Thank you for joining me for the fifth episode of Talk It Out. This week, we focus on Georgia, a state that swung to the Democrats in 2020 for the first time since President Jimmy Carter ran for re-election in 1980. Just 2 months after Joe Biden's victory there, Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won special runoff elections to the U.S. Senate, giving their party control of Congress's upper house. I first speak to Rebecca DeHart, the CEO of Fair Count, a nonprofit grassroots organizing group founded in 2019 by Stacey Abrams that works in rural counties across Georgia with Black and other communities of color. Rebecca says that the foundation of the group's work is based in ensuring a more equitable count during the federal census every 10 years. Historic undercounting of Black communities across the South, she explains, has deprived those communities of public resources and contributed to voter disengagement. By mobilizing these communities around the census, Fair Count helps build a civic infrastructure that counters the historic gap between white and Black voter turnout. I also speak to Chanel Haley, the Director of Education and Community Engagement at Georgia Equality, that state's LGBTQ advocacy group. Chanel highlights the importance of reproductive freedom, which she says is part and parcel of the LGBTQ community's struggle for bodily autonomy. And she emphasizes the crucial role that Black women play in Georgia elections. Chanel also makes some surprising observations about which prominent surrogates are most likely to spur enthusiasm for the Biden-Harris ticket among Black and Black LGBTQ voters. My guest is Rebecca DeHart, the CEO of Fair Count, a nonprofit group founded in 2019 by Stacey Abrams that builds long-term power in Black rural communities across Georgia that have been historically undercounted in the census every 10 years, have been underrepresented at the polls, and whose communities are often torn apart in redistricting. Rebecca is here today to discuss how access to the ballot box has historically and even recently been restricted, and how her group's work challenges that status quo. Thanks for joining the podcast, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca, the foundation of Fair Count's work, as I understand it, is based in the central importance of the census that the federal government carries out every 10 years, 2010, 2020, and now the one coming up in 2030. Can you talk about that?
So when Fair Count first came about by our founder, Stacey Abrams, you know, she was not going to be moving to the governor's mansion, and she had a lot of ideas that she could still do good even if she didn't have that role. And so she founded Fair Count knowing that a fair and accurate count in the decennial census is really the foundation for all of our democracy. Georgia, along with many other states, particularly in the Deep South, have been historically undercounted. White persons living in Georgia and in other states like ours are historically overcounted, while every other group is undercounted. And that really sets off a tailspin, a decade at a time, really, of redistricting, of districts that are not, that don't keep communities of interest together, that don't hear the voices. Undercounts lead to $1.5 trillion lost in federal dollars that would have flowed to those communities for more than 336 federal programs. So it's really critical that we start every decade with the most accurate data that we can, so that we can carry out our civic engagement and civic infrastructure there forward. So we started in 2019 in advance of the 2020 census, and we like to say that we're a little nonprofit. We're nonpartisan. We want everyone to be counted. We want everyone to participate. You know, we're a nonprofit that kind of runs at the speed of a campaign and is willing to try all sorts of new things to engage people who have been historically shut out of the civic process.
So you're doing community engagement with people on the ground 365 days a year.
Yep. And for 5 years strong.
And you've mentioned the impact on federal and I assume also state dollars flowing to these communities. Can you talk about how the work on the census relates to a mission of encouraging and protecting everyone's access to the ballot box?
You know, I like to think of civic engagement as almost flexing a muscle. You know, when you participate in one election, you're likely to participate in another election. You get invested in it. And the census is an incredible opportunity to be seen. If you're not seen, then you simply don't count towards the story of our nation for the next 10 years. So it's sort of a pivotal way of participating within your government and then seeing what comes back to you. You know, we always use Head Start, the program as a great example, because Head Start is absolutely 100% based on the census. And if young kids who are perhaps living in poverty, who need those services, if they're not counted, there will not be a Head Start space for them the next year in school. So it really shows that tie between government and the community and what people are owed and do by virtue of participating.
The work you do is focused in rural Black communities in Georgia. How was the choice made to make that the focus of your efforts?
And we also do some work in Native communities as well. Okay. And we do some work in Latin communities. Georgia is a very, very diverse state, and we are burgeoning on being what, you know, what some would call a minority-majority state as well. And I think what's really interesting about rural communities is sometimes there's a national perception that rural communities are white communities. But that is not the case in the Deep South. The rural communities are just as diverse as they are in urban areas like Atlanta. And there tends to be significantly less civic infrastructure. So when dollars and resources come in, you know, Atlanta is a large metropolitan area, and we have Savannah and Columbus and all these other cities. They tend to go to the Atlanta metro area and those 16 total counties with those bigger cities. And so you don't see as much connective tissue between the rural communities and participation. And we see that particularly in vote share, which is really important to us. We're a very data-driven organization, and we believe in an equitable electorate. And so what we see is if you have a rural community that is 50% Black and 50% white of registered voters, but only at every election about 40% of the people who are casting their ballot are Black, then you have a big vote share gap and you have an oversaturation of other voters. That with an equitable electorate, a racially equitable electorate, then people's voices will be better heard. So we did deep dive data analysis down on the county level and actually every state in the country. And we measure that vote share gap. And that's where we focus our efforts, where the largest vote share gaps exist. And what we find is a real lack of civic infrastructure. You know, these aren't places where candidates are going to drum up support. These aren't places where direct mail is hitting these rural mailboxes, because most direct mail services call the most rural addresses because they're more expensive. Places where cell phones maybe don't work as much all of the time, or they're pay as you go. So access to the internet isn't there. And these are also places that we've discovered are real news deserts, you know, defined by the lack of information that is coming in that is local and necessary for people to make decisions about the future of their communities.
So the vote share gap that you refer to, in general terms, is greatest in these rural communities.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great. It's pervasive across the Deep South. I mean, these are persistent historical gaps by design to cut some people historically out from participating, namely, you know, Black Southerners who have faced incredible odds, you know, over the decades. And, you know, I think it's so interesting. We look at these vote share gaps and then we compare them to census undercounts. And they're identical. So we knew right away our theory of change by working at the census, by working at voting and redistricting. You know, we never have to change communities. They're all one and the same.
You've already alluded to the fact that these communities, there's a lot of diversity there. Are there any general characteristics you can describe about these communities in terms of their economy, their economic well-being, their industry base, and also the question of how much racial segregation or racial integration there is in these communities.
Yeah, I think the South always surprises people with both of those, of how much segregation and how much integration, you know, can exist within these communities. But one of our tenets is that we hire our organizers from the communities where we work. And so that gives us sort of an edge of, one, training better, stronger organizers, you know, in ways that is not typical in sort of like a campaign setting. But two, it builds this trust and acceptance on the ground right away that allows us to really dig deep into a community because they may know each other or they know of each other's families. There's a lot of interconnectedness in the rural Deep South. We start every meeting with a one-on-one where we ask all the questions that you just asked. What's it like in your community? What is the main employer? Do you all have a pediatrician? Do you have a doctor? You know, what is voting like? How far do you have to travel to go to an early vote site? What is voting day like? What has been your experience? You know, and we have these conversations. And, you know, what we find, and, you know, this is a mass generalization, but what we find, particularly in our work, because we do a lot of faith organizing too, is that faith infrastructures are often sometimes the epicenter of sort of structure within those communities and great ways, you know, to reach people and to bring people together. And last year we did a big report where we interviewed 356 people in focus groups about why they vote or more particularly why they didn't vote. And over we hear it's local concerns, you know, it's infrastructure, the roads here, the schools here. Why can't we get anything fixed? Why doesn't anyone pay attention to these rural communities? Because rural communities have been facing a real uphill battle for quite a long time. And without that civic infrastructure to not only build power in communities, but also teach people how to wield that power, they're sort of left on their own. And so that's the gap we really try and fill.
Do these communities continue to be agriculture-based, or are there other employment opportunities that have emerged in these areas?
Yes, agriculture is still a huge force in Georgia. You know, in a lot of rural communities where we're seeing some of them that are the most hard hit in the past couple of years is the closure of all the hospitals that have been happening because of the refusal to expand Medicaid in Georgia. And so we have rural hospitals closing at an absolutely alarming rate. And those would often be sometimes the biggest employers in communities or the school systems, those types of things.
Can you describe in some detail some examples of the way you carry out your work and also how you partner with other community organizations in the areas that you're working?
I think this is what I love about Fair Count so much. We have a whole host of organizers. Right now we're in Georgia and in Mississippi, some of which who have been with us since the very beginning, which is kind of unheard of in the organizing realm. And as I said, you know, we start with these one-on-one conversations, and it's not just with the city council members or the county commissioners. You know, we're meeting with the teachers, with the librarians, with the church secretary who have their finger on the pulse. And one of my favorite questions we always ask people on one of our one-on-ones is, you know, if we were really wanting to get to know this community, who are the three people that we should talk to? And that will take us in a variety of different places, to the barber, to the person who is working in disaster recovery, because we're often hit by, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes, and more often than not, they hit and affect particularly Black communities and rural communities more. So what that allows us to do is really expand our view of traditional civic partnership. We're not just partnering with, you know, organizations that are registering people to vote or who are doing civic work, but we're partnering with organizations that have lived and existed within the community, that have that trust and that see a future for that community and are working together. So we're just as likely to partner with a school, a migrant farm worker health clinic, you know, a barbershop, a community center, a daycare facility, as we are the local NAACP chapter, or, you know, more of the civic-minded organizations you might think.
So a lot of the points we're going to be discussing here have to do with barriers and hurdles and restrictions. But can you talk for a few moments about some of the positive impacts that your work over the past 5 years has have had?
I'm really proud of the work that we've done in at Fair Count. You know, we really did a good landscape analysis and identified where the need was and where we could fill in some of the gaps, because Georgia has been a growing state with a lot of exciting things happening in it. You know, I think our first major success was an increase in the self-response rate in the 2020 census. And that was not easily come by. You know, for the first time, we had a sitting president who was fighting the count, threatening to call undocumented persons, stirring fear for people to participate in the census. And then, of course, the global pandemic hit 2 weeks before Census Day while we were out on our 70 rural county bus tour with iPads and internet and helping people get ready to do the census. So to improve our census rate in Georgia over 2010 was a big success. And it really showed us, you know, there's something here. This is something that we can be working towards to bring greater equity to our state and to the South going forward. We've done a lot of election work. You know, a lot of our team has had a significant experience working on various campaigns all the way up to presidential levels. And so we've really turned the work that we did with the census. It just went hand in hand with the election work. You know, I know the census in 2020 ended around end of September, October. We took one day and then we were back doing mobilization of the same voters. And it was great. We were knocking on doors in rural areas where they had never had their doors knocked before, right? Because there's not density in housing. And we would hear at the doors from people, wow, you weren't kidding. You really are here to stay. You know, you were here for the census and now you're here for this. So from the 2020 election to the 2021 election, where we had absolute record, incredible, record-shattering turnout, particularly by rural Black voters who were quintessential in their participation and in creating the most equitable electorate we have seen in Georgia in that 2021 United States Senate runoff that happened on January 5th. And then, you know, we've kept going from there, from through redistricting through the 2022 election and really diving in deep. We like to say to people, you know, for this year, we're keeping 1 foot in 2024 and 1 foot in 2030, because everything that we're learning and trying and strategizing, you know, we're not afraid to throw things up against the wall to see what sticks and how we reach people. We're cataloging all of that and building, you know, that base and that power for 2030. It's all very interrelated for us.
So before moving to the next question, I just want to clarify a statistical thing here. I think earlier in the conversation, you mentioned 16 urban counties in the state. And you also mentioned you do work in 70 rural counties. So you're covering a tremendous amount of ground within the state of Georgia.
We are. Well, there's 159 counties in Georgia.
Okay.
And about 16 of them we don't do a lot of work in because they're very metropolitan based, but we will work in some of the areas around them. We, based on our targeting, our priority counties, we really focus on upwards of about 70 counties that have, you know, the least civic infrastructure, the greatest vote share gaps, and, you know, the most undercounted in the census. And Georgia, when you get up north, there's not as much diversity. It's more white up north. And so we tend to work more south, Macon and south, down to the Florida border.
A day before the January 6th insurrection, another world-changing event happened, which was the two special U.S. Senate elections that resulted in two Democratic victories and Democratic control of the U.S. Senate. After that, after those special elections, Republicans in Georgia enacted changes in the way that elections are carried out there. How have those changes posed hurdles to ballot access?
I mean, they were significant. SB 202 was a sweeping measure that really changed the administration of elections top to bottom. There were everything, you know, from changing the way vote by mail works, which was heavily utilized, partially because of the pandemic, but also because organizations had been working towards it more and more. You know, it changed the way how you could request ballots, the time frame for them, et cetera. You know, it changed the timeline for runoff elections. We've had another runoff election since then. They're no longer in January. They're like the first week of December, which also truncates early vote, which is very popular in Georgia. We have 3 weeks of early vote, and about 50% of all ballots are cast during those 3 weeks. So when you really truncate that time frame, it makes it more difficult to get that out. You know, I think most infamously, people were, or the bill was banning individuals and groups from handing out food and water during long line. And that has been, of course, challenged in the courts, as many of these have. They banned mobile voting centers. You know, Fulton County, where the city of Atlanta is, had mobile bus voting, and that is no longer. And it also really changed how people can return their ballots, like drop boxes, for instance, which I sure wish right now we had a lot more of them with all the problems that we're having with the United States Postal Service, because these ballots that we just experienced in this primary election were delayed so significantly. But, you know, during the 2020 election, drop boxes were put all over the county in places that were easy for people to be able to return their vote, their absentee ballot. And SB 202 really limited that. And they, I think they said it was, I think, one box per 100,000 active voters, and they were most often with inside the Board of Elections itself, and so only open from 9 to 5. And we saw a huge drop in people returning their ballots using drop boxes. And for an organization like us, one of the hardest things to kind of look at was that you couldn't have third parties mail absentee ballot request forms anymore to voters. So, you know, during the pandemic, I live in DeKalb County, which is also part of Atlanta. DeKalb, the county itself, sent every resident that was registered to vote a request form so that they could do it by mail. That has been banned. Counties, cities, and also third parties can no longer do that. And that was a really great way to be able to reach voters that weren't otherwise connected or who are in rural areas who have to travel a long way in order to get to their early vote location and sometimes their precinct.
So can those request forms now only be obtained through state offices, state of Georgia offices?
That's right. And they have to have, it has to have wet ink on it. So, you know, before, the Secretary of State in 2020 had this website that was super easy to use. I used it. My family used it. You know, you went in, you gave your driver's license number, you put your address, it clicked with your voter registration, and then your ballot was sent. No longer. Now you have to go in, you have to be able to print out the form, which, you know, I'm a CEO of a nonprofit. I don't have a printer at home. Not a lot of people do, particularly in the communities where we're working. You actually have to print it out, put your wet signature on it, and be able to send it back in for then the county to be able to send you a ballot.
Have there been instances or are there concerns about direct voter intimidation at the polls?
I mean, there's always concerns, and there's certainly concerns this year as we see heightened political violence, not just in the United States, but around the world. We are concerned about it. We have seen some, you know, in my former work before I worked for Fair Count, I definitely encountered some. You know, what we see now more is intimidation practices. You know, you might see law enforcement with their lights whirling out in front of a polling location before you go in. We're always worried about protesters and different things that will engage, particularly when there are lines, and the lines in Georgia are infamous. But I think, you know, a little bit more than that, I think what makes it harder for people to vote is the change in their polling precincts, change in early vote precincts. You know, there's been a big move for particularly rural counties to consolidate their precincts, to have less number of them, which makes it harder for people to get to, or perhaps they're located in a place where they don't necessarily want to go, or it's a side of town that's not as welcoming to all. They've continued to introduce more legislation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we were really concerned about this year is they passed a bill this spring that allowed the Board of Elections supervisor for that county to decide how many machines would be put in each precinct, because we vote by machine here in Georgia. And mm-hmm. before, you know, they had to follow a formula, one machine per 250 voters. But now it's really up to the supervisor, and they could put a bunch of machines in one location and not enough in another. And so we're nervous a little bit about what might happen in November and what could make it harder for people to vote.
Does the state and or the counties have an obligation to notify voters of a change in their voting location?
Yeah, they do. They have a website, My Voter Page. If anyone in listening is from Georgia, I highly recommend you constantly go to My Voter Page and look up your voter registration. Another bill that passed this spring that we're very concerned about, and we'll start to see the effects of it in July, is it's made it easier for individuals to challenge people's voter registration en masse. We've already seen more than 200,000 challenges since the bill came, and it really got codified this year. And those challenges are going to start in July, and they're going to go until September. And people have a right to know if their voter registration has been challenged. And, you know, likely the counties will have to contact them if they decide to investigate the challenge and not dismiss it. But there's a lot that can happen to people's voter registration without them even knowing.
Are those challenges posed by organized groups?
Yes. And, you know, it's wild. This year, it's been in the AJC several times that Eagle Eye, this organization that's trying to challenge Eric for keeping the voter rolls, that's based out of Columbia County in Georgia, True the Vote out of Texas, is actively recruiting volunteers on the ground to challenge the voter registrations of individuals throughout the state.
My Voter Page, is that myvoterpage.gov?
It is mvp.sos.ga.gov.
You've had redistricting, obviously, since the census at both the congressional and the local level. How has that redistricting affected the political power of rural Black communities?
I mean, rural Black communities don't have the political power that they deserve in our state and in states across the South. One of the hardest things that we have had to deal with was this is the first major redistricting we went through after a census since the Voting Rights Act was really Section 5 was really gutted, which protected a lot of communities of interest. And no longer do maps have to be pre-cleared by the federal government before they're put into action. And it really turned into the Wild West in Georgia and across the South, more and more partisan gerrymandering and a lot of fights about what actually constitutes racial gerrymandering. I mean, I think we've had more cases reach the United States Supreme Court that have come from the South, from Alabama, from Louisiana, from South Carolina, that have really dictated and they've actually forced the bench that we have now at the United States Supreme Court has forced these states to go back and draw maps. Georgia was forced to go back and draw maps, and we had a special session. And so there's, you know, slightly more partisan equity than there was in the original maps. But I think, you know, what we saw a lot was ways to sort of crack, pack, and stack districts in ways to minimize Black voting power and have Black, you know, majority districts, but have them so tightly packed and stacked in there that it still minimized the overall numbers, the overall power. You know, they went back and had to change some legislative seats to create more majority Black districts. And most of those seats were created out of districts that were Democratic and who had, you know, a white elected official or who had sort of like a multiracial coalition put in there. So we saw some pretty drastic changes that didn't really overall affect the balance of power as we see it in Georgia. And we really, really hope and what Fair Count advocates for, because we are, of course, we're nonpartisan, but we see redistricting as a process that should be led by individuals and by communities and by people to maximize their voices so they have a direct line to their politician rather than to be completely shut out of the process, not to be talked to for the next 10 years. And so we spend a lot of time in redistricting. We actually got mapping software and we created more than 400 community of interest maps with interested parties in rural Georgia and gave them to the legislature. They kind of take this into account when you're drawing these districts and, you know, there was no change. We have an extraordinarily uncompetitive state where most of our races were decided in the primary that just happened in May.
Right.
And this lack of competition does not at all serve historically marginalized communities.
You do get out the vote efforts come election time. What do those efforts look like?
You know, they look a lot like you would find on a campaign, you know, from education to mobilization. But more than that, I think they're built and rooted in this power and within communities that we've been working with. When the pandemic hit, we did vaccine distribution in rural areas because it's no surprise that the same places that didn't have access to vaccines were the same places that were undercounted in the census and the same places you saw the greatest vote share gaps. I mean, all of this is very tied together. So we've built a lot of partnerships and a lot of strength in these areas. And we talk to people about voting. We help people make a plan. We try and be educators about all the changes in the laws that constantly happen here in Georgia that make people sort of question, you know, should I participate? Will my vote count? Does it even matter? They're making it really hard. And we also try and be a little more creative and reach that sort of non-voting population in ways that we sort of know how. You know, we go back to those original one-on-one forms. You know, we'll find out if there's something that in that community that, well, one of my favorite examples is with the census when we found out that there was, you know, 70 counties that don't have a pediatrician in Georgia, more often than not the same counties that we're working in. We hired pediatricians in a roving van to come down and give free checks while we educated their parents about the census and helped them fill it out. We try and do really unique events like that, that will bring people together, that also strengthens the community and sort of fulfills a need. We love to do a bus tour and we love to take that bus through the smallest towns and rural areas and watch as entire towns come out to dance to the local DJ and eat food and learn about voting and why it matters and why their power matters. So we'll be doing that all the way up through the election. And then it's not just about mobilizing voters. It's also making sure their votes count. So for the 3 days following election, my team works nonstop, calling all the boards of elections, finding out who voted provisionally and how we can help them cure those provisional ballots before the deadline on Friday. And it matters. In states like Georgia, where elections are very tight, national elections and statewide elections are very tight, every vote should count. And we don't feel like our job is done until those elections are certified.
Rebecca, for listeners to the podcast who are in a position to help and are interested in helping your work, what opportunities are there?
Absolutely. So one, visit our website at faircount.org. And there's a place that says get involved right there on the top. And there's a little form about volunteering. You know, we will have out of state phone banks, text banks, et cetera, letter writing campaigns, all of the things to talk to people. We have tons of opportunity on the ground here in the state if you want to attend an event. Of course, we're always fundraising. The more money that we are able to raise this year, the more we put it directly on the ground and hire more organizers. So we would love any sort of, you know, resource effort that anyone has, and anyone who wants to go out and see sort of, you know, what they call God's country down here, this beautiful place in rural Georgia that where we believe, you know, when things are decided on the margins, where you work on the margins.
Rebecca DeHart, CEO of Fair Count, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. My guest is Chanel Haley, Director of Education and Community Engagement at Georgia Equality, which advocates on behalf of that state's LGBTQ community and its allies, including those living with HIV. Chanel was the first African-American transgender person hired by the Georgia State House of Representatives, and she has served as chair of the Atlanta Human Rights Commission. Welcome to the podcast, Chanel.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Chanel, as you look to the November elections, what do you see and what do you hear from folks around you as being the most important stakes for the LGBTQ community in Georgia? And then drilling down a little bit more specifically for Black LGBTQ Georgians.
So right now, I think healthcare is a big issue for us. There's a fear that healthcare was being stripped. In Georgia, we don't have Medicaid expansion here. there was always a fear around that, particularly one around gender affirming care and any care related to HIV is a major issue for the community here in Georgia. So when Obamacare came along, where it looked promising, of course, in Georgia, wants to buck the system and, you know, double down on being against Medicaid expansion. To add to our allies and to partner with them around bodily autonomy, you know, this is one of the states that also has the one of the abortion bans, right? And me, particularly as a trans Black trans woman, I definitely cannot be silent about that because that is bodily autonomy. And me, my entire being of who I am is also body autonomy. You start telling women what they can and cannot do with the reproductive system, you start telling me what I can and cannot do with my body also. And so there's that. That also translates into the Black community as well, because overwhelmingly, mortality, maternity rate of death here in Georgia is the highest in the country. And so that translates also to all childbearing individuals who are of African descent in Georgia. And so that's also a major issue too. I've already talked about HIV, which we know is also prevalent and very high when it comes to the African-American community around also poverty, socioeconomic norms and housing, home ownership. I mean, you name it, it affects all communities, but also definitely the Black community too.
So is it fair to say that for Georgia, equality, abortion rights, and right to choose, and women's health care have always been integral to the overall mission of protecting bodily autonomy and bodily dignity for all Georgians?
Of course. You know, I know that when people think about, you know, body autonomy or pro-choice or, you know, abortion, they always think about, you know, different sex couples, right? You know, heterosexual mm-hmm. and, you know, man, woman, that's it. But there are, of course, several women, several people with uteruses that get pregnant and that choose to or choose not to, for whatever reason, that wants to give birth to a child. So the same way that abortion is not is necessarily only for opposite gender loving individuals, the same thing when we talk about, you know, housing affects everybody in the community, every LGBTQ also, healthcare, you know, workplace rights. We as a community are part of every of the community. And that's what people usually don't really associate, but absolutely. And again, especially as a trans person, I'm definitely going to say that that's probably higher on my list than anything else. Because when you start trying to tell a woman about her body, that's also me. You're also telling me how I should look and how I should walk and talk and dress and what restrooms and what I can do. That's the same thing.
And I also want to underline something that I was think you suggested, and that is that in terms of maternity mortality and infant mortality, Georgia ranks, unfortunately, very high. And I'm assuming that that's particularly high in the African-American communities. Am I interpreting what you said correctly?
Absolutely. I was speaking particularly of the African-American community, and it's because there is not a trust when a woman goes to the doctor and makes a complaint or concerns, she's mm-hmm. not believed. Again, something that as a trans woman, I can relate to. When I have an ailment, there are doctors who would say, well, if you just stop taking those hormones, that ailment wouldn't be there. But that has nothing to do with my broken arm. My broken arm is broken because of what I did, not because of hormones I take.
You're responsible for education and community engagement. So what are you seeing out there at this early stage in the election year in terms of enthusiasm among LGBTQ voters?
Fortunately, I would be honest to say that I'm not seeing enthusiasm.
Okay.
If we're honest about the conversation, that most of Americans are not happy about, are enthusiastic about either candidate, you know, for various reasons. But we as a community and as voting citizens in America have to make the smart decision that it's, you have to vote. You just have to vote, regardless of not if this is not the person that you would plucked or picked that represents pick the person that represents your values to the best of the ability that you can, so that we don't fall into a society of where there's damage that is done for the next 10, 20, 30 years, because that's the outcome. That's what happens when you are selecting a leader, that there are laws and policies that are created that will affect you for a long term. And so that's what I've been kind of educate when I go to communities, is that I know that you're not invigorated and that, you know, you're not excited about your candidate, these candidates. However, think about which candidate is it that actually cares or will do and advocate for policies and create legislation that actually will protect your livelihood, your safety, your mortality, and that's who you should be voting for. I have to keep this very see-through here, so I can't say certain people's names, but right. I hope people get the picture.
I appreciate your frankness on that assessment. There are key pieces of legislation that various parts of the community expected. The Equality Act, certainly. Voting rights Absolutely. Legislation. Even student loan forgiveness, where there have been some major developments, but it hasn't been across the board. The president hasn't been able to do everything he wanted to do. Are those the kinds of things that have dampened enthusiasm, or is it a more general lack of engagement?
It's more of a, I would say actually it's a more generational lack of engagement. It is that there is a divide in where there is one side that is just loyal no matter what. Then there's another side that needs to be inspired. And the inspired ones are the ones where I have to do the education on. It's like, okay, I get that you want to be inspired and wear t-shirts and be proud about it like you were, you know, back in 08. But however, look at the policies though, and that should be it. You know, this is taken to another level. This is where you have to make those decisions. I don't want to remind you that you were told the same things I'm saying now back in 2016 about you can't always be inspired. Look at the bigger picture. The bigger picture in 2016 to me was the Supreme Court. And just like clockwork, what happened was is Supreme Court choices were made that will now affect my generation, the next generation, and generation after that, because of the choices that were made when it came to voting or not voting during that election. And so you have to think past your enthusiasm around candidates. Think about what it is that will better your lives. Do that. Not about if you want to, you know, back in the day, a certain candidate, it was, that's why I want to have a beer with. Screw the beer. Have a beer at home by yourself while you're watching the returns, right? Or while you are enjoying the luxuries or the enjoying your livelihood that was given to you because you made the right decision around who you voted for. Enjoy that beer then. That's what I try to talk about and let people know. And then more importantly also, I feel in this nation, particularly myself, who's someone who's very engaged with a certain party on different levels of the party, even as an officer, is that what I've learned is we do a horrible job in America when it gets to party politics, the actual stages of what each level does, how to be more engaged, reaching out for engagement prior to the election. And so by the time you get to me saying, hey, are you going to vote? They're like, you only want to hit me up now because it's time to vote. You want me to vote for your person. And that's a tragedy that we do every 4 years and we seem to learn that we should have started earlier.
And I want to get to that a little bit later, but I just wanted to drill down a bit on what you said here. Obviously, I think you're referring to younger voters. I can actually remember, Chanel, when 18-year-olds first got the right to vote. Yes. And for decades, the turnout among young voters, despite the excitement about younger people being able to vote, the turnout was not that impressive. And we saw with Barack Obama, obviously, a young candidate, a historic candidate, a very charismatic candidate. He generated tremendous turnout for younger voters. And we've seen some, at least from what I've seen, we've seen some continuation of that, not at the same level, but some pretty good continuation of young voter engagement in the process. And we also have seen that young voters in the elections since 2008 have been disproportionately Democratic voters by a big margin. So they've been a very important demographic for the Democratic candidate. And you're suggesting here that that is a caution sign this year.
I'm suggesting it's a caution sign for two reasons. Number one is because you mentioned former President Barack Obama, or at that time candidate, he was a candidate that they was excited about. And then being very specific about younger demographics is that they're easy to jump the bandwagon, so to speak, jump ship, because they're engaged, they're energized, but then when their person loses, okay, well, it didn't work, so I'm out. We saw that here in Georgia with the Stacey Abrams campaign, the first time she ran for governor. Energized, engaged, excited, very similar as they were with Barack Obama. And then she lost by a small margin, and then they're out. We know from marketing, 30 seconds is all you get. That's right. Twitter, X, Instagram, you know, images, that's all you get. You have to get them in that time period or they're out.
Let's turn to Black support for the Democratic candidates. In 2016, 2020, Hillary Clinton and then Joe Biden are reliably estimated at getting more than 90% of the Black vote, which is consistent with historic patterns. The organizing and turnout among Black women in Georgia in 2020, and then in those two special Senate elections 2 months later in January of 2021, are pretty widely seen as critical to Democrats winning the state of Georgia those three times. How motivated and mobilized do you see women in Georgia being this year?
Black women are always going to come out and vote. Let me tell you from my own personal experience. I grew up in a household where it was talked about, it was discussed, this is who we vote for. It's always been in a Black household, and this is on almost every socioeconomic level, is that Black women are encouraged to vote because of history and of how women allowed are given the right to vote, how Black people were denied the right to vote. And so it is taught in household. So I think that you could always depend on the Black woman to vote. Black men can be iffy. Youth can definitely be iffy. I do worry about, I will tell you something that I have seen recently, particularly in Georgia, is that a lot of our front runners when it comes to running for office, particularly from the Democratic side, have not done so much targeting. Maybe because their attitude is that they're going to vote regardless. I don't care. I need to focus only on the youth vote. And I will tell you that as a person of a certain age, I'm quite offended by that, because why would you ignore your base chasing after a maybe? Okay to always go for the maybe. I have done, you know, worked on campaigns before. And when you are looking at your walk sheet, you're looking at, you know, who you're going to call for, whether it's canvassing or for phone banking or canvassing, you start with the middle. Mm-hmm. So these are the people that's in the middle because you need to sway them. Mm-hmm. But then you go into your definite, like these people are definitely going to vote in your party. These are your strong supporters. And I definitely need to reassure them that I am exactly the candidate and meet the values that they want. So you don't ignore them just because you know they're going to vote one way or the other, your way. You still have to engage with them to make them show up to the polls. And so that's the biggest issue that I see when it comes to attracting or speaking to the Black liberal voters.
From your assessment, mainstream political groups, not your group necessarily, not other focused advocacy groups, but the mainstream organizing groups are to some extent dropping the ball in terms of doing sufficient outreach, for example, to the Black community?
I would say, when we say groups, I would say political parties. Yeah. As a group, Georgia Quality, what we are focusing on, and this is across the board, is voter registration. We don't target and ask people, you know, what party they're in, how they're going to vote. we want to grasp and get the numbers of more people to vote, particularly in certain areas. So I'll tell you these past 2 years, which is a term for our General Assembly, that legislation that attacked the LGBTQ community came from a certain state senator from a certain area. So mm-hmm. we need to go down there and get more people to register to vote who are like-minded, and mm-hmm. hopefully we'll get a like-minded candidate that will rise from that to get that person out. That's how we operate, you know, coming from a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization in that way. The other way that what you're referring to is something that I say that the parties are doing bad. One party in particular, I would tell you, you know, I mean, Democrats just are not engaged as long as they need to be with as many people as they need to be. They show mm-hmm. up way too late.
That, I assume, is in part that they're taking Black voters, for example, for granted.
Okay. You said it. I did it.
Fair enough.
I don't want to get voted out of my position.
When you do your work, and you discuss your work as very targeted, issue-focused and targeted. So you see a particular issue that's become hot in the legislature in Georgia, for example, and you look at, okay, where can we have an impact on how that issue is going to play out in the state legislature? Is that the way you do that?
For the most part, yeah, we have to look long term. Again, because we're nonpartisan, we do have to look at who's in office, what legislation have they put forward. Is there a way that we can kind of build up our base there where we can get people in that position or that area that will be more fair-minded? I want to be very clear that people think that, you know, Georgia Equality is some liberal organization. And no, we have worked with Democrats and Republicans around putting forth legislation before and passed it, RFRAs that have come up over the past years. The former governor, Governor Deal, who was Republican, he vetoed that. We worked with him. We work with everyone, whoever it is that is in support of our community. But if there's a legislator that is putting forward legislation that is targeting our community, then we definitely will want to build up our alliance in that area in hopes to get a fair-minded, I said fair-minded, elected official there. And that is definitely how we operate around the state.
And just for our listeners to clarify, the RFRA issue you referred to, that applies to religious exemptions from non-discrimination.
Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So that's religious exemption. So that is where a person can deny services, goods, or access based upon their religious beliefs. No, I don't sell products to you because you're gay.
Right.
But people, when I make the connection, as the educator, when I'm speaking to mass people, I say, this is not a I hate gay people bill, because remember also, religion also has to do with, you know, divorce. If you're a divorced individual, they could also say that I do not want to provide services to a person who is divorced or who's a single parent. So that's what's important for people to realize when it comes to RFRA legislation.
Are there groups that you typically partner with in your advocacy, voter mobilization efforts in the state or nationwide?
Sure, there is. You know, you brought up earlier about Black women groups. There are several women groups that we partner with. Women's Health Centers, Amplify Georgia, SPLC, HRC, obviously. We are open to partner with almost any group. In 2023 was our first year of having a faith organizer. So we did a lot of work with faith communities. That means churches and having ministers there. Every day during session, Georgia General Assembly, there was called preacher of the day, minister of the day. And so for the first time ever, a trans woman, that's a pastor at a church who was a minister of the day there. And so we partner with several people in faith communities. We try to make those connections all the time. We understand that LGBTQ person is part of every community across the board.
Going back to the issue of Black community support in recent election cycles, there has been some talk recently that There has been erosion of support for Biden among black men. A recent Wall Street Journal poll looking at seven swing states came to the conclusion that as many as 30% of black men could vote for Donald Trump in November. Are those numbers that resonate with what you're seeing out there?
I have two separate answers I'm giving you. I'll give you the important answer is Georgia Equality has not crunched those numbers. I got to give you statistics on that. So there's that. The other answer I can give you is as a member of the black community and, you know, who is on Instagram like everybody else and who's probably looking at what you looked at, is that what I have observed, and this goes back to what I said earlier about who is easily swayed. Black girls, black women are taught in the household about how they vote. Black men, not so much. And, you know, lives are also very different. And so when you see the rhetoric on social media, which is where this comes from, you know, a black man will say, well, you know, Trump gave us, you know, a check. Stimulus checks. I'm going to vote for him again. Because he said we'll be back in. He's going to give us a check again. You sell your soul for $1,500. That was, you know, that's one payment of maybe if you, a mortgage, if you have a mortgage. So I'm not going to say that what you saw and heard is not true. It actually probably is. However, take it with a grain of salt. Because typically when people talk that way, they also don't show up. They're busy that day. Let's stick to who we know shows up. You know who shows up? Black women show up of all ages. Senior citizens show up. That's who shows up.
Last question for you, Chanel. Standing here in the early spring, what is your sense of the direction Georgia may be going in November?
I think it's going to be a squeaker. And I think that that is determines on who is sent to Georgia to engage with the voters. Voters, particularly of the Democratic Party, really need to be excited. So who are they sending out to rally them and to talk and say, hey, this is why it's important? Because, you know, I'm just Chanel Haley. I'm a nobody to the masses. So I can go and speak if I want to certain communities and they might care, they might not, right? But if Michelle Obama speaks, even if they didn't even go to it, they saw it on the news and, okay, I'm happy. If she's happy, I'm happy. That's how that goes, right? So I think that it depends on who shows up here because it also shows who's invested because we know who shows up means there was money put behind it. And you put money behind your mouth, that's where wins come in. We will do our part at Georgia Equality around voter registration and voter engagement. We have a team already in place around voter registration. In fact, before I got on this call with you, I was actually sending out requests from technical schools around Georgia about allowing us to come in and do voter registration there. So I'm reaching out to young voters, you know, trying to get them registered to vote, make sure that they know that even if they've moved, voter registrations in Georgia need to be up to date. The voter registration deadline, we are targeting certain areas. We are doing our part here. But I think that it would be a very close call again, because unfortunately, there is still a group of people in our nation, and not just in Georgia, but our nation, who wants to see what would happen if he's actually in prison. Can he still be the president? There's people who actually want to see that. The people who want to just blow some stuff up, like, go for that and see what happens. And so we have to be vigilant and think long term about our lives, you know, the Supreme Court, about Medicaid expansion, about our health care, about, you know, our housing inequities that take place. And of course, our bodily autonomy. I really want to like to see that, you know, codified, which should have been done a long time ago.
Very quick follow up. There's very few superstars at the stature of Michelle Obama. The Vice President, Kamala Harris, has taken a lot of flack in the last 4 years. Is she a figure who, if she came to Georgia, would generate a lot of excitement?
Kamala Harris has been to Georgia already. I was kind of serious, like, can I tell a lie? The answer is no. So she is obviously a person of importance and of power because the vice president has been mostly silent throughout her tenure. It's on deaf ears of coming in at the last, you know, final hour, but like, hey, I'm the person. That's why my opinion is she's not the one, and I haven't seen people excited about her there. Not to mention, she also has the attachment of her as being a former attorney general. And in the climate that we're in, people are not fans of police or police adjacent people. So there's that. I mean, Bill Clinton would be better.
Thank you again for your frankness. Chanel Haley from Georgia Equality, thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks again to Rebecca DeHart from Fair Count and to Chanel Haley from Georgia Equality. And thanks to all of you for joining me again this week. For more information about the work Fair Count does in Georgia and elsewhere across the South, visit faircount.org. And if you're a Georgia voter and want to confirm the location of your polling place after recent changes in state law, visit the official Georgia website, My Voter Page, at mvp.sos.ga.gov. For more information about Georgia Equality's voter registration and mobilization efforts this year, visit georgiaequality.org. Looking to next week's episode, I'm in the process of talking to groups on the ground in a variety of states, including Michigan and Nevada, and our lineup is not yet finalized. So please check in on Wednesday, July 3rd, to see what we have in store. Talk It Out is available on Apple, Spotify, and other podcast platforms.